Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Very happy to be joined today by somebody who's not been on the podcast before, Jasper Scherer. Jasper is a politics reporter for the Texas Tribune. Though he is like what, the politics editor elect?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
You weren't really elected per se, that I would think.
No, that's not, to my knowledge, how they made the decision. But yes, incoming politics editor.
There we go. Incoming. Okay. Yeah, you haven't put it up for a popular vote.
Right. Not yet.
Okay. You'll choose your moment like a parliamentary system. Good. So he will be the politics editor for the Texas Tribune starting in June. Jasper's been reporting on politics in Texas since at least 2017 that I'm aware of, and joined the Texas Tribune in 2024, and now joining management. So welcome, Jasper. I really appreciate you making the time to—
Of course. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm I'd say a sporadic listener to the podcast, so I'm happy to be on.
Well, I think you're, you know, you're ahead of most in terms of the listenership, so— So, you know, until you move to a corner office, you're still in the trenches at the Capitol. And right before we recorded this, you broke some news, shared a byline with Kayla Guo at the Tribune on Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. So let's do some news first and tell us about that, what you found out.
So essentially, Kayla and I sat down with Patrick in his office and had the opportunity to ask some questions about, you know, basically these are kind of his two of his top pet issues, two of his top priorities this session, banning THC products across the state, and then, kind of tightening the state's bail laws, giving judges more discretion to deny bail. And what he told us is that he's essentially, ready to, and he has done this before. This is not a new maneuver for Dan Patrick, but basically he will use his power as lieutenant governor to block, you know, certain must-pass bills to force a special session, an overtime round, if it gets to the point where the House doesn't come around on those two issues. So I don't know. I'm not making any set in stone summer plans at the moment.
Yeah, it kind of puts a crimp in people's June plans. Now, on that hand, I mean, we were talking about this a little bit before we went on. I'm curious. You know, you're not making summer plans, but you guys had good background in the story about the fact that, you know, Lieutenant Governor's done this before. It's something that is in Lieutenant Governor's toolkits, if you will. I can't remember if you had a quote from the Lieutenant Governor. You guys were pointing it out that, you know, he can't call a special session. He's not constitutionally empowered to do that, but has been very good at, you know, being a gatekeeper and you know, knowing that he's got a chokehold. What do you were in the room with the guy. How'd you take it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an element of this that it could just be, you know, this is sort of a bargaining chip. You know, it allows him to establish his position a little more firmly when they start doing negotiations with the House. And it's worth noting that that Patrick and also the author, at least on the THC ban bill, they have both expressed some degree of confidence that, you know, they're either on the same page with the House or they're going to get there. And you were sort of alluding to this before we went on. Like, I do think there is a powerful incentive for folks to not, I think the people are going to pick and choose which hill they're going to die on this session, given how many overtime rounds they've been stuck with, the last 4 years. I mean, this is a part-time legislature, as we all know, and, you know, these folks have other jobs they need to get back to. So, I don't know, that to me is not should not be glossed over when you're thinking about the factors or kind of the tools in the toolbox.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things in play here for me that, you know, one is, and I would have to go back and look at this to make sure. I don't think this is 100%, but I always feel like there's more of an incentive to get the work done in the regular session, not have the stories be about the legislature and the governor not getting along or not being able to govern or whatever, when you're going directly into a big general election year. You know, the off-year election when all the statewides are on the ballot. You know, and so I think, you know, I think about that in play. And then I also think about something that's underlying even, you know, both of our reactions to it, I think. And that's, you know, a certain amount of PTS from the breakdown in the 2023 session and just how long that lasted, how many special sessions were there. Now, that was impacted by the Paxton impeachment, of course.
Right.
But it's all kind of part and parcel of the same thing. And I think the same collective memory and, you know, the kind of collective trauma of the people in
totally.
The building.
And you can tell just with the kind of the early tone that Dustin Burroughs, the new speaker of this session, is setting with his relations with Patrick, you know, the caveat that all of this can, you know, change and go south at any point as we get closer to May. But, you know, just he's from, by all accounts, you know, they're still doing their big three breakfasts with Governor Abbott. You know, the Patrick and Burroughs, like, you know, converse fairly regularly. So I've heard. And, you know, I think, you know, and Burroughs has, you mentioned the Paxton impeachment. He was, you know, this is kind of maybe a political posturing thing, but it makes sense that he did it. He made a show of kind of turning over the, like, the audit records from the House to kind of swage Dan Patrick. So I, you know, I think, you know, for now, at least the rubber hasn't really met the road on a lot of these bills, but you can tell that Burroughs and the leadership in the House, a lot of whom were involved in all of those kind of endless negotiations. Burroughs was, you know, in the mix for those property tax discussions. They're eager to avoid that, I'm sure.
Well, that leads me directly to what I kind of wanted to go next, which is a vibe check. You know, you described how it's all that seems a little more smooth. You know, are you finding that palpable in your reporting? Are people, do you sense a little more harmony? Is too strong a word,
yeah,
but a little less just of the depth of the, you know, the hostility and the, you know, right, everything was a conflict in 2023 by this time, I think,
right,
in the session, only got worse. It does seem like it's better.
I think so. I mean, yeah, the short answer is yes. Like, I think everyone is, you know, eager to, you know, even just thinking about within the House with some of these new freshmen, kind of the firebrand, farther right crowd who came in, having campaigned on sort of upending the status quo in the House, even, you know, at least some of those folks are, you know, just trying to be engaged as productive lawmakers on certain issues, as opposed to just coming down and just, you know, burning the place down from the jump. So I think, you know, and we saw some rumblings of censures by, you know, local, like county Republican parties that, sort of quietly died down. And, you know, that to me reflects just folks wanting to, you know, who were critical of Burroughs' predecessor, Dade Phelan, kind of wanting to give him a chance. So all that said, though, you know, I think there is also, we're talking about the vibe, like folks are starting to get maybe a little antsy about just, you know, this always happens where the Senate jumps out to, you know, they get all their priorities done and then the pressure is on the House to follow suit. And, you know, but I think just maybe some of it is like the session started a little early, later in January than we're used to. And, you know, I'm hearing stuff about, you know, maybe the House wants to get the budget out of the way before they jump on some of these other things. But, you know, they, with especially the private school voucher, the whatever you want to call it, education savings account bill still out there, I think until that gets resolved one way or another, everyone's going to be kind of walking on eggshells to an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it can be hard when you're in the middle of a session, I think, to separate the general rhythm of these sessions, which are, you know, it's very structured. in a lot of ways. I mean, with variants, but very structured by the Constitution and the rules and what's particular to a given session, right? So you raised vouchers, and I think, you know, we'll weave this vibe thing in and out a little because I want to come back to talking about the big three a little bit more. What's your read of where the vouchers thing is? It, you know, on the surface of it, it seems like they're pretty close, like they pretty much have the votes. I think the ESA voucher, you know, the // proponents,
right,
you know, are all guardedly optimistic, though in talking to some of those folks, nobody will go, yeah, it's going to happen.
Right.
Certainly not on the record or even informally. People are like, yeah, it looks good, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that, you know, it seems like that's pretty much a done deal, failing, you know, a Hail Mary procedural thing or the bottom falling out in some really unexpected way.
Yeah, I think that's more or less my impression. I mean, there is, you know, I haven't really heard a super, I guess, compelling case from the Democrats that, you know, actually this coalition, and it is a narrow coalition in the House of the folks who have officially signed on to support the House voucher bill, but I haven't really heard much in terms of like concrete opposition from Democrats. You know, it's more just, you know, oh, there's plenty of time for the bill to change, or, you know, vaguely kind of some of these Republican votes are, you know, reluctantly on board. But it's, if you think about, you know, the countervailing factors, I guess, with just looking at how Abbott went so scorched earth in such an unprecedented fashion, you know, last primary session, and it just, you know, it's the way the winds are blowing in a very clear direction right now. And I think maybe the one kind of big variable we're waiting for is like what the latest House draft of their bill looks like. Brad Buckley, the education chair, told us that, you know, he's expecting kind of technical changes on the version that'll eventually get sent to the House floor. And if that's the case, I would be surprised. I haven't seen anything to indicate there'd be, you know, major defections in the House.
Because as of now, I mean, last I heard, they're looking to, they think they're planning on voting it out of committee next Tuesday.
Right.
And then we'll be, you know, the attention will turn to when the first calendar's committee meeting will be in the House.
Right.
They're going to schedule the thing. You know, I think vouchers is a good place to kind of weave back to the big three for a second. I mean, we heard one of the big leading indicators that the train seemed to be, if not leaving the station, ready to pull out. I guess it was last week when we heard kind of this joint announcement from the governor and the speaker. And as we look at the news you broke today of the lieutenant governor shooting up a couple, you know, firing a couple shots across the bow on these key issues for him, and, you know, particularly what is the thing that nobody wants to hear because of the vibe we're talking about, which is, you know, we'll hold this hostage for a special session. You know, what do you make of the relationship between the big three? I mean, look, it's obviously better, and, you know, what used to be the niche interest in who's having breakfast together is now like a leading indicator, right, of how well things are going. But kind of what's your sense of that? Because it still feels like the usual unstable triangle to me. It's just that the polarities have shifted a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, just thinking of, you know, the new variable, obviously, in that the third, you know, stool peg there is Burroughs coming in. And I, you know, by all accounts, he's always had a great relationship with Governor Abbott. You know, this is sort of a deep cut reference, but thinking back to when Burroughs was kind of at his lowest point after he was involved in the, you know, recording scandal where he and then Speaker Dennis Bonin were caught, you know, kind of scheming to go after certain Republicans in primaries. You know,
and he was, in very unkind language in some cases.
Right, right. Yes. That is important context. But so he was, you know, just in the eyes of his colleagues in the House, which, you know, everything in that body comes down to, you know, the reputation and trust you develop with, you know, you're only as good as your word in the House. And you know, Abbott just didn't really have to do this, but he came out and endorsed Burroughs for reelection, you know, right as all that stuff was happening. It's a small thing, but I think, you know, and then thinking ahead to, you know, the role Burroughs played with, you know, property taxes in 2019. You know, his ties to Abbott go back a ways, and I think, you know, it was sort of a weird situation for the two of them with this the speaker race, where Abbott was kind of trying to. My read on it was like he was trying to, you know, curry favor with the, you know, the base, the folks on the right who were supporting Burroughs's opponent, David Cook. But, you know, he didn't come out unequivocally support. It was sort of a guarded statement of support. So it sounds like those two at least are on the same page. And then, you know, with Dan Patrick, it's kind of like every speaker he's worked with so far, things have fallen apart at some point. You know, there's, you know, I'm having trouble remembering what the vibe was between Phelan and Patrick at the beginning, but it was, you know, we saw that collapse in pretty dramatic fashion.
And pretty fast.
Yeah. So it's sort of like their relationship is only as good as, you know, it actually, as the House is doing what Dan Patrick wants and expects them to do. And the challenge for Burroughs, like, it's really easy to see how this could theoretically fall apart if you know, his coalition is overly reliant on the Democrats who voted for him, you know, into the speakership. And some of these, you know, I guess we could call them social issues, you know, on Dan Patrick's priorities list. There's a lot of stuff on there that House Democrats who voted for Burroughs kind of en masse, they're not going to like. So I don't know. It'll be fascinating to see how Burroughs kind of tries to you know, weave through those forces in the last 2 months.
Yeah, I mean, this is way too immediate and short term to think about, you know, the chess game going on here. But it's hard for me not to notice that shortly after there are these signals in a reasonably public way, at least for the audience, for this stuff that. Of this relationship and the cooperation between Abbott and Dustin Burroughs, that all of a sudden, you know, we see the lieutenant governor kind of shooting arrows in their direction a little bit, and not right at them, but
yeah,
kind of, hey, I'm here and I still have
right.
I still have some leverage here.
Yeah, which is, I'd say, very on brand for him, based yeah, on what
it's very on brand, and not to be wonky, but it's also very on brand for the inherent instability that the Constitution sets up in those relationships.
Right, right.
Right, I mean, it's much more exceptional that those three are all on the same page historically, you know, than the norm of the built-in friction manifesting itself.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just thinking of the constituencies that elect, you know, those two leaders when you're, you know, I mean, it was essentially a majority of Democrats who got Burroughs into that position, and Dan Patrick's there because he is better than anyone else in the state at reading the kind of the tea leaves on the right. So those are, to your point, there's always going to be some tension just by, you know, the folks who are getting these two leaders into their positions.
Yeah, right? What the roots of, you know, how yeah. the roots of their power
exactly yeah.
expressed in the selection process. I think that's right. So, okay, I want to talk a little bit about some media stuff. But before we get to that, what else are you seeing? Like, what do you... You know, you're spending a lot of time in the building, sounds like, in the lieutenant governor's office. Look at you. I don't know where you guys had the interview, but...
Yeah, yeah. He brought us in.
Assume he didn't come to you.
Yeah, no. He's not at our beck and call by any means. Yeah.
And I don't want to, you know, lieutenant governor is a very strategic thinker, so I'm not... You know, all of a sudden, you know, you're on the Christmas card list or something.
Right.
But what else are you watching that's a little more below the radar? You know, other things that you're keeping an eye on? You know, other things, you know, kind of as a unit you guys are watching, but you in particular, like you're walking into the building, you're kind of, what are you watching these days?
Yeah. Well, first thing that comes to mind, I don't know if this is top of mind for everyone, but I've sort of by default been covering a lot of the, like, I guess the sin issues, like related to, you know, put THC in that category, but also gambling, sports betting, and stuff with the lottery, and, you know, that's another area where Dan Patrick centrally involved trying to crack down on the state lottery. I mean, I'm fascinated by, you know, just, it's hard to miss, like, all this army of lobbyists that the, you know, especially Las Vegas Sands, kind of the main casino gambling legalization advocates are, you know, sending to just descend on the Capitol every 2 years. It's kind of becoming a routine at this point. And I'm interested in how, you know, this kind of the shakeup with the lottery, you know, Dan Patrick putting his considerable muscle behind, you know, potentially even just doing away with the lottery outright. I think he's been clear saying that that's on the table. You know, I think it's interesting to look at how that is affecting, you know, the odds for these gaming interests, because they have, you know, they've struggled to kind of make a dent. They were never going to get anywhere in the Senate. I think we all knew that. But kind of the whole ballgame for them was to just incrementally move the ball forward in the House. And I think the kind of just the vibe with the lottery has colored the whole, you know, everyone sort of puts these issues in the same basket. And it's just fascinating to see all the money that is poured into these lobbyists. And it could end up being a step or two backwards this session, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, reasonable people can disagree, and people have disagreed with me as I've had conversations with them. But it's hard for me to not feel like the instant the lottery thing came up, that the lieutenant governor saw the opportunity for kind of a bank shot here, you right. know, to start talking about, you know, the difficulty of regulating even this thing that's this form of gambling that's been in existence and is institutionalized.
Right.
And he doesn't necessarily have to say, and so the on so the and so follows so naturally under the other things that would almost be malpractice if that wasn't part of the strategy if you were opposed to gambling.
You would think so. Yeah, for yeah. sure.
You know, I think the other thing that's interesting about that, you know, you talked about the, you know, the pages and pages of lobby registrations for the Sands. I don't want to be cynical, but a cynic might say, well, it's almost certain that the people giving advice to their clients in this space have been saying for a long time, this is the long game, it's going to be multiple sessions. And while I'm, you know, I'm sure they'd rather get it done and have the feather in their cap and et cetera, you know, a step backwards is, you know, a step forward if you've got a contract in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's a fair point to make. And
I'm not suggesting anything nefarious, but structurally, course, yeah. when you're involved in a big issue like this and you're hired on right. and you know it's going to take a lot of section, the setbacks are frustrating and you are fighting the battle. And as sure. a warrior, you're...
Yeah.
And I know from seeing some of the people with these contracts shortly after this all broke up, it, you know, they were not happy in any way.
Right.
But structurally, it's going to be interesting to see how long, you know, the hiring spree continues
right.
In the lobbying space.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, and Sands has, you know, they did not expect this to be like an easy ride by any means. This is, I'm sure, was kind of baked into their, you know, their game planning from the outset. And I'm also interested in just how this all plays into the 2026 primaries. Just if you think about, you know, the same folks who are sort of spending these unlimited amounts of money on the lobbyists, it stands to reason that, you know, maybe they'll, I think we did see Miriam Adelson get at least sort of dip her toe into the water a little bit last primary session in the House. And, you know, I think Governor Abbott kind of set the tone and maybe opened the floodgates a little bit for what we should expect, you know, as far as just that sheer amount of like outside activity, outside spending in these House races, which traditionally are, you know, it's more than your average city council race, but it's, we're not talking, you know, traditionally it hasn't been these like
big seven figure, you know,
yeah.
expenditures, which we now see more routinely is a little strong, but
right. So that's, you know, to your point earlier about just how the 2026 considerations kind of in some ways color everything that's happening at the ledge right now. I mean, this is yet another example of that.
So let's talk about that. Let's just direct that head on. So
sure.
what do you, we're looking at 2026. We know the comptroller's race is going to be open.
Right.
Not decided, but a lot of anticipation that the AG race may be open. This is, to my mind, even if the governor and the lieutenant, and the governor, I think, is running again.
Right.
Lieutenant governor, I think, is a little more questioned, though, certainly, to take him at his word.
Sure.
Right now, he's saying he will run again. But just opening up the AG and the controller's office really opens the floodgates, it seems to me, you know, because of the ripple effects on people wanting to run.
Right. I think so. And it's also just adding to the equation, like the kind of the pent up, you know, the, how stagnant things have been for, you know, I guess since 2014. I mean, this is the first example of a true vacancy like that, aside from that the Ken Paxton primary that we saw, and then the land commissioner office opening up. But
a couple aside, railroad commissioner seats here and there, but those are not, you know, I mean, look, those are important, but
kind of these,
and no insult to the railroad commissioners, but they're not marquee races.
For sure. And I think, so just all that like pent up, you know, folks maybe being in positions a term or two longer than they would like to, are going to be chomping at the bit to run for either of those two offices. And, absolutely, that has ripple effects down. I mean, I, at least, you know, in the Senate, I think that has traditionally been kind of the launch pad for a lot of these statewide races, looking at, you know, where Ken Paxton and Glenn Hanger are the two current occupants came from. And, you know, everyone's throwing all kinds of names around. I mean, I would be surprised if we don't see, you know, multiple Senate folks, throwing their hat in the ring for either of those two offices. And then the question comes down to, you know, do those senators have to give up their seats, and how big of a ripple effect do we have? But
who's got a free pass and who doesn't?
Right, yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's, and that's one of the more interesting things about it, is that, you know, the thing itself that, you know, we're going to have competitive primaries in 26. I mean, I think for a long time, I felt like the Democratic side was going to be pretty active too. I still think that, but I also think it's a little hard to read what's going on with Democrats everywhere right now, because there's just so much disorientation.
And right. Kind of still reeling from the sucker punch, I think. Yeah.
No, I think that's right. And so it's a little harder to read, but I mean, I think if you look at, you know, there are Democratic state senators that I think would like to throw their hats in the ring and check it out.
Definitely.
Know, that have not run statewide, that have a free pass in 26. And I think, so I think, you know, you got to watch that. And if the AG's race loosens up, and if Paxton winds up entering the Senate primary, rightly or wrongly, I think Democrats will see him as more vulnerable than your average Republican.
Sure.
Because his, you know, their argument would be that, you know, his overall polling numbers, while they're very strong among Republicans, are not as strong as one might think among, or Republicans might hope among, the general electorate.
Right. Which, and to be fair, we've heard similar overtures like that before, and it's, at least thinking back to the last time Paxton was on the ballot, it was, he was just almost as big of a blowout as all the other statewides, so.
Right, no, he definitely was, I mean, he did not get too exempted, or he was not kept off the wave.
You know? Exactly.
I think that's right. That's an interesting point. So let's talk a little bit about media, and, you know, it's a little unfair to you, I'll stipulate that, because you're not formally moved up, but I'm gonna assume that you had not been moved up if you didn't have some thoughts in this area.
Yeah, no, let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about where you think, as of now, the Texas Tribune kind of fits into the, you know, the media ecosystem, particularly in the political world. There's been a lot of evolution there, and I'm interested in your thoughts, because you're not, at this point, you haven't been like a Tribune lifer, right? You worked for the competition for a few years beforehand, and I think that gives you an interesting, potentially interesting perspective on where the Tribune fits in and where things are now. So kind of what do you make of it? I mean, obviously, it's part of the broader media environment with all this change and the partisanship and perceptions, et cetera.
Right.
But I'm just wondering about how you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of different ways to tackle that. I mean, I think, just to your point, yeah, I have mostly been observing the Tribune as an outside admirer for, you know, going back for most of the over 7 years I've been in the state. And I think, you know, one thing I have noticed just kind of over time is, to me, it feels like the Tribune has shifted a little bit. You know, I really thought of them as more of the kind of the consummate insider, you know, publication right alongside Quorum Report, where that was, you know, the MO. And people at the Capitol still read us. You know, we still want to be their go-to, you know, source for news. And the fact that we, you know, don't have a paywall, I think, just, I love how accessible our reporting is to everyone. But, you know, I think we have been more intentional about, I say we, you know, in the years since I've been at the Tribune, but also the organization going back a number of years now has been more intentional about taking our reporting outside the Capitol, centering more of our stories around just the lives of everyday Texans, how, you know, what happens at the Capitol is, you know, playing out and affecting the 30 million folks who live here. And, you know, that's something I want to continue thinking about as politics editor when I move into that role. Just it's, you know, we want to be the publication that you know, Senate and House staffers are reading, and we want to be talking to all those folks. But we also, you know, I don't want to take our eye off the ball for, you know, what our real purpose is, which is informing Texans about, you know, what's happening under the Pink Dome and in Washington as well. You know, not just kind of in a palace intrigue sense, to put it crudely. But, you know, I have also, just as a reporter, encountered firsthand, it is sort of in vogue these days to, you know, especially in a Republican-dominated state, to, you know, make the media something of a punching bag, or, you know, I've definitely noticed just, you know, we have to work a little extra harder these days to, you know, get Republican voices represented in our stories the way that I would like as a reporter. And I think, you know, some of that trend is maybe overstated a little bit. Like a lot of the people who, maybe not a lot, like at least some of the people who will, you know, badmouth us in public will turn around and talk to us, you know, that same afternoon, and that's great. But, you know, I think it's kind of on us right now as an organization, and it'll be on me as I move into this editor role to just be thinking creatively about how to confront that challenge. And also, you know, I think it's just, we've had some staff turnover. Some of this is just a matter of, you know, building trust over, you know, a number of years, just, you know, showing up, being present, doing reporting that, you know, establishes to folks on both sides of the aisle that you can be trusted. It's kind of, you know, a slow burn sometimes. And I'd love to bring some people on as we're filling out this politics team who are going to, you know, stick around for a little bit and build up that trust and sourcing at the Capitol.
That was all very well put. If I was to be more blunt, I mean, it seems to me what's sort of sitting there on the table is that there came a point, it's hard for me to say exactly when it happened, maybe a couple of sessions ago, where the mood towards the Tribune at the Capitol really turned, and there was just, you know, it was kind of an article of faith among a lot of conservatives that the Tribune was biased against conservatives. I mean, that's my perception. Is that fair?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I'm not talking about the conclusion, but
right. But
I'm not misreading that, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I also would have trouble pinpointing the exact moment, but, you know, been at least for a couple sessions now where that's sort of been a bit of the vibe. Yeah.
You know, you talked about working, you know, working harder to get more, you said, used the term Republican, conservative, whatever, points of view into the stories. Is that, I mean, do you think the degree to which that's almost, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you know, a little bit remedial? I mean, how do you think that happened? I mean, what's the mix of that happening maybe unconsciously and there being a conscious effort on the parts of some people to kind of shut reporters out?
Right.
What's the mix?
Well, I think,
I mean, there's a chicken egg question here maybe,
but it's a very,
but
yeah.
You know, you have to be careful about the premise, and I don't want to put a premise in, you know, your mouth.
No, I think, I mean, the second point you made, especially about, you know, I think that gets at how, you know, irrespective of, you know, how conservative folks on the right side of the aisle feel about our coverage, there's just been this overall trend, you know, I'm not breaking any news here, of just and I mean, really on the left too, but, you know, I think especially on the right of, you know, conservative politicians and folks in the political sphere, identifying these other avenues to get their message out without having to go through the mainstream media, you know, whether it's, you know, legacy print newspapers, you know, these up and coming online nonprofits, whatever the case, you know, there are just so many more like endless ways to connect directly with constituents without going through, you know, what they, I'm sure, perceive as sort of a filter that's inconvenient to them. So that's, you know, no matter how fairly or accurately or diligently we cover the Capitol, you know, that will always be a reality that we're confronting. And to an extent, I can't, you know, blame them. And, you know, I wish they talked to us more, but it's like, if the options are available, you know, we always think about like when LBJ would sort of the cliche, he used to call the reporters, you know, over to his ranch and, you know, sort of thinking about like the good old days when everyone was just, you know, there was all this access. And it's like, I imagine if LBJ had all these, you know, the avenues that are available now, he would be
not
taking advantage of that too. I think so. I don't know. It's kind of a silly example, but you know, that the point is like, it's tough for us to get around. And I think I would just go back to, you know, some of it also is like, we need to, you know, make sure that our reporters are sticking around at the Trib, and that, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of establishing to skeptical folks that, you know, we're just like, we're humans. You know, I, you know, you see my byline, but you know, I actually exist in real life too. And I don't wake up in the morning thinking about, you know, what kind of,
how to foment the revolution,
right? What kind of messed up angle am I going to pursue today? You know, it's just sort of being there and putting in the work. And so I do think a lot of it too just comes down to like, you know, thinking of Patrick Svitek, one of the former politics reporters at the Tribune, you know, when he left the organization, I guess it was around a year ago now, the reaction, you know, on both sides of the aisle was pretty much uniformly like, you know, positive. He had a fantastic reputation as a diligent, fair, well-sourced reporter. And some of that was, you know, he was here for like 9 years. I mean, that's just, I think, part of the secret sauce, you know, but yeah.
You're getting people to trust, you know, be familiar with you and trust you. And that takes a lot of iterations, I think.
For sure.
It takes somebody talking to you and off the record and feeling like you didn't burn them, you heard them,
right?
The View got in, things like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm hopeful that, I mean, we were talking about the Lieutenant Governor talking to us the other day. You know, it's, I think, you know, that makes me hopeful that we'll get, you know, more engagement with some of the statewide folks too. Like Speaker Burroughs has been, you know, he's done not a ton of media availability, but you know, he's, you know, it's not a total black box either. And, you know, even with the governor's, you know, folks and just his availability to talk one-on-one with us, it's kind of been hit or miss, but you know, I guess I'm hopeful that, you know, as we especially build up our new politics team and bring in, you know, I think we have a great crop of applicants to replace some of our outgoing.
Because you guys are advertising for two spots now. It's basically your, is that what, I assume that's basically your spot and James Buttigan's spot.
That's right. Well,
with
and
James
then,
now at Capitol
and then
tonight.
Also Rob Down and one of our other politics reporters jumped over to Texas Monthly. So, and we did bring on Kayla Guo to fill one of those three openings with having to backfill my spot as well. So, but yeah, hopefully we'll replenish, you know, rebuild our team before, you know, I'm kind of dancing between these two roles of being a reporter and also a incoming hiring editor. So I'm just as eager as anyone else in the newsroom to get staff back up. Yeah.
Alternating between committee hearings and job interviews.
Exactly. That's pretty much my, my daily schedule these days.
Well, you're holding up well, my friend.
Well, thank you.
let's finish. I want to finish by just enjoying being able to ask you this unless the other way on. So anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
Oh, do I say that at the end of our interviews? Yeah, I feel like I probably do.
Well, you almost certainly have at some point.
I always feel bad asking that, but sometimes I get my best stuff coming out of those.
Well, that's why
questions,
it works.
So
yeah,
that's why I do it.
I mean, it really works if you can do it with the Davy Joe Montgomery approach. Which is, you know,
the impression.
Wow, this has been really great, Jim. You know, anything else? You know, this is really, I wouldn't have thought of any of this. Is there any? And then you almost inevitably say something you shouldn't.
Yeah. I feel like that might be my cue to not say anything in this case, just learning from the best. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, Jasper, thanks a lot for coming. We really appreciate it. And, you know, maybe hope to have you back after you start over there again.
That'd be great.
If not before.
Yeah. Sounds good.
So thanks to Jasper for being here. As always, thanks to our excellent audio production team in the Dev Studio of the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. And of course, thanks to you for listening. And we'll be back soon with another second reading podcast from the Texas Politics Project. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.